Okay, welcome to the second conversation in the Data Domain Conversation series. My name is Kate Coucherman, hosting this series which accompanies the exhibition that's currently on at Dunoon Borough Hall, entitled Data Domain, Modern African Art from the Argyle Collection. Now, last week in this series, we talked about Naomi Mitchison, the prolific writer and Argyle County Councillor who founded this public collection, the Argyle Collection, in 1960, and whose travels to the African continent in the 60s and 70s led to the acquisition of paintings, prints, and drawings by a number of notable African modernist artists. And this week, I'm joined by three more wonderful guests for a conversation specifically about the region and the cities of the African continent that Mitchison visited on her travels, particularly the cities of Nairobi in Kenya, Kampala in Uganda, and Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, which we know she spent some time in. So with me today, we have Anna Adima, Leverhulme Trust Doctoral Scholar at the University of York, where she's working on a PhD about women's writing in Uganda and Kenya, which is part of the larger collaborative research project, Another World, East Africa and the Global 1960s. We also have Angelo Kakande, artist, art historian and associate professor at the Margaret Trowles School of Industrial and Fine Art at Makerere University in Kampala. Angelo has been a Fulbright Scholar at Illinois State University in the US and senior research associate at Rhodes University in South Africa. And he's an expert on Ugandan art history with a particular interest in the intersection of art and politics. And finally, we have Elspeth Court, research associate at the Center for African Studies and former lecturer in world art at the School of Oriental and African Studies, or SOAS, University of London, as well as being, of course, an expert in East African art history, particularly Tanzania and Kenyan art. Elspeth spent extended periods in Dar es Salaam and in Nairobi in the 1960s and 70s, and looking forward to hearing some of her personal recollections in our conversation today. And Angelo and Elspeth were both part of the African Modernisms project at Iwalewa House at Bayreuth just a few years ago. So to get started, I wanted to just invite our guests today to reflect a little generally, broadly on what these very different cities were like, Kampala, Dar and Nairobi, when Mitchison would have visited them. We know from the bits of archival material we've been able to find that she was in Kampala and Nairobi in 1966. That seems to be when she bought some of the first works of art. And she was likely in Dar es Salaam in 67 and then later in the 60s too. So Anna, I wondered if you might kick off. You've written specifically about Kampala in the 60s and some of the sort of energies, the creative energies of that city, particularly from a kind of literary perspective. I wondered if you could share your sense of what the city would have been like in the mid-1960s when Mitchison came to visit.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kate. I often kind of joke that if I could travel back in time to any period as a historian, then I'd love to go to Kampala in the 1960s, simply because I just love the sound of the city from the sources that I've studied. I think it was a very vibrant city. There was culturally, there was a lot going on. And it's said in several sources, they indicate that it was a very liberal city, and certainly amongst Ugandan upper classes and with wealthier expatriates, there was a lot of mixing going on, which was very much in contrast to Nairobi, where I believe that the quasi-apartheid state, as a result of the emergency, was still very heavily implemented. Mm-hmm. And Kampala was also a cultural hub, largely because of Makerere University, which, because of the English department there, under the leadership of Professor David Cook, who was a British professor working there, who basically tutored and mentored some of the biggest names in East African history today. Some of the biggest writers, such as Ngugi wa Thiong'o, Rebecca Njau, Jonathan Kariara, Elvania Zirumu, or Rosenboa, they all passed through the English department in the 1960s, and you know, later on became some of the greatest East African literary figures. Mm-hmm. So it's also, I feel, no coincidence that the 1962 African Writers' Conference was also held at Makerere in Kampala. But also, I think I should add that also outside of, the confines of the Ivory Tower, there was also a lot going on, like with Rajat Niyogi and his magazine Transition. And he also regularly hosted literary salons, which were attended, by writers, artists, intellectuals. Ngugi Wa Thiong'o actually attended some of these, which he writes about in his memoirs later on, where he actually met Barbara Chimenye, who was a very famous East African children's book author. And Ngugi writes later on that these parties, they were quite unique in the sense that people of all races came there, which was different to some of the expatriate parties held in Kololo in Kampala. And he basically said that this they kind of signified a new Uganda and a new Ugandan society forming after independence. And there's culturally, there's a lot going on. There was art galleries such as the Nomo Art Gallery. There were music societies. Drama was also very big with, for instance, the Makerere Free Traveling Theatre, which was established in 1964, which is basically a Makerere-run theatrical society, and plays were written by students. And they traveled around Kampala and Uganda to perform plays to people who wouldn't normally have access to, theatres. Probably as famous as was the Kampala Amateur Dramatic Society, which, no, at the time, sorry, it was known as the Kampala Amateur Theatrical Society, which still exists today. At the time, it was mostly expatriates, and they also regularly performed, I don't know, like plays and pantomimes at the National Theatre in Kampala, which was established in 1959.
That wonderful overview gives a real sense of what I think Mitchison would have been enormously excited about. I mean, she herself was a hugely prolific writer, of course, but in her home in Argyle was sort of famous for holding amateur dramatics events, and would have, I think, really been enormously excited by the clear energies in Kampala. And we know that she contributed to Transition in particular, and we can certainly, I think, circle back to the specifics of Transition as a publication soon. But I think certainly that the kind of literary energies of Kampala would have been of were clearly of an enormous interest to Mitchison. Elspeth, I wondered if you might come in and talk a little about Dar es Salaam around this time too. And I know Nairobi you were in a little later, but perhaps you could share something about those two cities that you knew personally.
First, I'd just like to respond a bit to what, first of all, thank you for inviting me,
You're very welcome.
also for meeting everyone else. But I'd just like to very positively respond to what Anna has said. I mean, I'll show this. It's called
Yes.
Origin East Africa, an anthology from Makari, with a
Yeah.
drawing by Elie Kayuni on the cover. And you probably can also see how very old this is. This is my copy from the 60s. It was published in 67, where from my position, where I was teaching on Mount Kilimanjaro, Uganda was very much, as Anna described it, we looked towards Makari for cultural inputs, and that energy we could feel because the teachers I was teaching with, I think four of them were Makari graduates, plus so many other people that I knew. So it was very much the where we looked to for that kind of new energy and post-independence expressive creativity. Dar es Salaam was actually quite different because it was as dynamic and as beautiful. It was always exciting to be in Dar, but the times that I was working in Dar or were very much associated with work, workshops. When we first arrived, we were at the Co-op College at a place called Kivankoni. I was in the Peace Corps, I should probably mention that. So we were almost immediately engaged with the socialist project of Nyerere. I mean, it was just everywhere at that point, which I think was different from the generally liberal social ways that Makari and Kampala represented. But then on return trips to Dar, I lived on Kilimanjaro, but during my holidays, we had more workshops and this kind of thing, and those were usually held in Dar. And one of them was at the place which I can't remember the name of the school and training center, but for the South African resistance movement. And you were very much part of that. You felt part of that. That was a Swahili course that I was taking there at the time that I was also doing some work in the museum. But I felt very much engaged with Dar es Salaam and the things that were going on there. And they were varied, but usually in some political way. who also workshops at the University of Dar es Salaam. And that was the time when Walter Rodney was teaching and Terry Ranger. So it was extremely vibrant, but the art was primarily the Makonde. It was actually before Tinga Tinga. The art, to me, I had more of that on Kilimanjaro with Ilimo and Jao's Kibo Gallery and some of the other things which were going on. But those two cities were just so dynamic. So that by the time I finally, for Kenya, my initial trips to Kenya were to visit historical sites at the coast with the Kilimanjaro Historical Association. That was a trip actually sponsored by the British Council. There were only two European or white people on that trip. The rest of them were African history teachers from Kilimanjaro. And that was incredibly exciting. I didn't get to visit Nairobi for another year or so. And it was just sort of shocking to me to be in a place that was so quiet and seemingly, it was a business center. It was not yet very African. Even by the time I moved to Nairobi in the 1970s, there were rules which kept people in the countryside, or social practices, political practices, like there weren't enough schools for African children to attend. And I don't really think Nairobi came into its own until really probably the 80s, when all is said and done, if I'm being honest. It still had a large character of your colonial hangover, plus the certainly in the 60s, Kenya had only been independent for a couple of years. Yeah. Hadn't really recovered from the emergency or in any way looked towards a more integrated society, apart from something perhaps like the Chemchemi, but indeed that was an external organization. It was not a Kenyan indigenous organization.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's probably worth just expanding a little bit on Chemchemi, because this was the place we know that Mitchison bought one of the first works of art. She bought Hezbon Owiti's painting, which is in the gallery. Mm-hmm. The Kenyan artist who had just returned from Nigeria, where he had been the Embarimbayo print workshops. Chemchemi was a sort of, it was a bit of a one-off in the cultural scene in Nairobi, because Nairobi remained.
It was certainly a one-off because it was an imposition. Right. Given its history we know now with the connections with the Cultural Freedom Organization and all that, it sort of didn't work because they brought in externals also for teaching the workshops. That was Julian Beinert, who took over when Exekle Mafaleli left the project after 2 years. Mm-hmm. However, Elimo was there, and Elimo Njau had already been a curator with the Soresby Gallery in Nairobi, which then became the new Stanley Gallery. And then Payapa grew out of Chemchemi.
Yes, yeah. So this is an important thing to note, because we think of, you know, Kampala as this, you know, vibrant intellectual scene, particularly developing out of the university, but as you stressed, Alan, not solely based in the ivory tower. Nairobi, very much still a kind of city, a segregated city, part of a kind of white settler colony, what was a white settler colony, but with something like the Chemchemi Creative Center, which had attracted important African intellectuals to it and also hosted important exhibitions. And Dar es Salaam, as you've also said, Elspeth, another, you know, a place of kind of great energies, also a place of great political discussions and debates, particularly around Julius Nyerere's program of socialism. Now, Angelo, I'm hoping that you might also come in at this point and talk a little more about Makerere as an institution, because it is this profoundly important institution, and it is this place with this very important art school. And I know, Angelo, that you not only are currently obviously teaching there, have worked there for some time, but this is the history of this place is something that you have studied very closely. So I'm wondering if you might be able to share with us a little bit about what the art school would have been like in the 1960s.
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me and also to have me speak to this question. The question of what was happening at Makerere University, which was a college by then, never became a university of East Africa until 1963. So the art school, see, the way the Magotao had conceived the art school was that it was supposed to serve region. It was never conceived as a Ugandan enterprise. So it had attracted many students, And it had also attracted many instructors from Europe and also from Uganda. The record is not that very clear, and that's because some people would come and serve without necessarily becoming part of the payroll, but they were interacting with students in the art school. I would say that a lot was happening, and the students at the art school were aware of what was happening. But let me just speak about one particular instance, which I thought split the art school into kind of two diametrically opposed versions of exactly what should happen to the art school after independence. And after independence could be anything. If we say 9th October 1962 was the date of independence, it's as if we're saying, okay, so there was a line, midnight 1962, 9th October, and therefore what was before and what was after. Or we can allow ourselves to see this gradual shift from what was colonial to what was post-colonial. Whatever direction we take, it divided the art school. So Elimo Njauke was born in Tanzania, then it was Tanganyika, born there in 1932. He came to the art school to join what Trawo had now created as a diploma of fine art. So he was one of the first students on that program. And he graduated with a very, very good diploma. I think it was a first class diploma. And then he normally would have come to teach at the art school, but he wasn't accepted. Instead, he went to teach in Makerere Demonstration School, where he taught in 1959 to 1963. Thereafter, he went partly through Tanzania, but then he went to Kenya, where I think he still is. I hope I'm right on that fact. Mm-hmm. So I was saying that he helped a number of learners at Makerere Demonstration School, but there are also learners who came to him, and he called them his private pupils. And the most notable of them, I think, in my view, is Francis Nagenda, a professor of sculpture, who is my own professor as well. So let me say this, that although Njau received, and I think received the best of colonial education, he held very radical views. Njau did make this very, very strong point, and I want to quote it. So he said, "We have not washed our face to see a new day with new heart and soul after colonialism. When you look at yourself in the mirror and the shadow of your colonial professor is standing behind you, you only see a blurred image of yourself." So I'm so glad that George Chayune managed to capture that statement, because it shows you how, although he had the best of colonial education, he probably had a very, very different view about his colonial professors, and he doubted whether they were going to be the best to teach at Makerere Art School and in Uganda, mm-hmm. as Uganda and Africa were moving into the post-colonial dispensation. So in other words, for Njau, post-colonial art education had to be redirected away from its colonial roots. Mm-hmm. It had to be given by African and not by colonial instructors. So Njau advocated an art education which trained students using local and not, and insisted on that, not imported materials. For example, he would have preferred the use of anthill soil rather than importing the Winsor & Newton Rhone colors. He would have preferred banana fibers, natural dyes, and he was concerned also that the graduates of Makerere College generally and those of the art school had, and somebody spoke about this idea, an ivory tower mentality. And for him, this kind of elitism blinded them and prevented them from addressing the pressing challenges that affected their communities. Now, I think in my view that Njau's creative practice was probably not as radical as his statements against his colonial professors. And I think it was aligned with the topical issues of the 60s. However, some key instructors at the art school rejected his radical views towards non-native instructors, mm-hmm. whom he referred to as colonial professors. For example, head of school, the late Cecil Todd, and his colleague, Jonathan Kingdom, brother Jonathan Kingdom, identifies himself more as a Tanganyikan than what India would have hoped to say. So Jonathan Kingdom, in my view, is as much an African as Ngiao himself. And the other guy who didn't like Ngiao's views was Gregory Maroba. And in fact, Maroba thought that what Ngiao was saying was a form of racism. Now, it's very interesting to hear an African rejecting another African as being racist. I could go on and on, but I guess I should leave it at that.
I think this opens up to a very rich discussion. I hope Anna might, maybe you might come in a little bit here in terms of some parallels in the literary world. You get this sense that Mitchison would have arrived in a world where, which is rife with debate. You know, this isn't just the kind of world where everybody's universally united in a singular celebration of one vision of the future. There is considerable discussion about what role art should be playing at this moment in time, what artists should be doing, and indeed, absolutely, the position, the lingering position of Europeans, obviously teaching in an institution like Makerere that has its origins in colonial administration. You mentioned Margaret Trowell, of course, the art teacher, who we will probably come back to, I'm sure, when we speak about Samuel Ntirho in a little while. Anna, did you want to come in maybe and share some thoughts on kind of literary parallels to the debates that Angelo has laid out in terms of what's happening at Makerere, the art school?
Yeah, thank you, Kate, and thank you, Angelo. That was absolutely fascinating. And I found it so interesting to see so many parallels happening in the English departments of both Makerere College and University College Nairobi. So which I didn't mention earlier, that these English departments, they had student publications as well. So at Makerere, it was Penpoint and Dana, and in Nairobi, it was Busara and Nexus. And browsing through these pages, you can see those debates, the students thinking about these debates as well, about, you know, decoloniality and Africanizing the curriculum. And, you know, there's student interviews with Professor David Cook asking him how should African literature be taught in African schools. And Pio Zirimo, who was a staff member in the English department, one of the few African staff members in the English department, Makerere, writing, calling, you know, for a radical change in the literature curriculum and that African literature should be prioritized. And actually in Nairobi at around the same time in 1968, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who had returned from the University of Leeds with a postgraduate degree. So Ngugi wa Thiong'o, Okot Bitek, Tabando Leong, and Henry Anyumba, they launched, you know, you could call it a revolution. And they wrote an essay on it called The Abolition of the English Department, where they basically called for the creation of a department of African literatures and languages. And they basically wanted to change the curriculum completely and to argue that why are we studying, you know, European and English literature? Why can't we study Kenyan and African literature and have a curriculum that's more relevant to our needs? Even in Nairobi, in the student in the student publications there, you could see these debates taking place with one student who was studying for an education diploma. She wrote, you know, how is drama being taught in African schools? Why are we studying, you know, Shakespeare or other English plays when that have little relevance for students here, when we can study, I don't know, The Black Hermit by Ngugi wa Thiong'o, where students can much more easily identify with the characters in those plays. And it's those debates that Angela talked about happening in the art world were happening in the literature world as well. And that was, I guess, the zeitgeist, if you will, of East Africa in the 60s.
Elspeth, would you like to perhaps come in? You have written about Margaret Trowell. You're an expert on kind of some of the earlier years of Makerere. But you also, I mean, Samuel Ntirho is an artist that you know well. When Mitchison purchased a painting from him, he was already fairly established by the late 60s. He was ambassador to London. He had a painting already purchased that was in MoMA. He probably was the most established of all of the artists that she bought from. But he is also somebody who is implicated in the world of Makerere because he's educated in the years of the colonial education system.
Yes. First, I really appreciated Angelo's comments about Elimo. I hadn't heard that before, about why he was teaching in the demonstration school, and also that he was also showing students work. That's very interesting to me. It's also my understanding that Sam was one of the teachers of Elimo. And that's where I'll go back to Margaret Trowell. Margaret Trowell started out in London in the 30s and knew that she was going to be working in Africa. She first lived in in Nairobi. And in fact, she did some teaching of art when she was in Ukambani in Nairobi, where she met the carvers whom she somehow brought with her to Kampala when they eventually moved to Kampala. Her husband was in the teaching in the medical school. Anyhow, what she also brought the ideas of Marion Richardson. Trowell herself was a graduate of the Slade and is a very talented portrait artist. But after she graduated from the Slade, she went to the Institute of Education and studied with Marion Richardson. And I think this, what she learned from Richardson, I think is actually quite significant, because it's the kind of pedagogy which is taught to Sam, also taught to Maloba, but he didn't accept it, and to Elimo, which is that they're visualizing and drawing from their images in their head, as well as from what they see, so that they're able to imagine this kind of new world. So Trowell had this notion of art teaching that she wanted to try out. I mean, basically, it's an experiment. And I think she saw it to some extent that way too. But she actually received her MBE for the work which she was doing in collecting material culture for the Uganda Museum. I mean, the Uganda Museum actually started in 1909, but she reinvented it in the 40s with her collections. And I don't know yet, I mean, I don't know to what extent she actually made use of those collections in her teaching, but they would have been around. And certainly her value of those things was there. That's a kind of sideshow to the actual teaching of drawing and painting, which went on. Mm-hmm. She was able to start out in a sort of a very small way, as everybody knows, in the veranda of her porch. And gradually the art course became more institutionalized. She, like Mitchison, had this idea that her students were like her children. The only time I've met it was at the time of the exhibition called Sanaa in 1984 at the Commonwealth Institute. Her students weren't there, but as I walked around with her to look at the paintings, she would talk in Luganda, and her daughter was doing some translating for me, and then also in English about how my child is doing so well. But she very much regarded them in this maternal way, yeah. Like I think Naomi Mitchison does. It's very much not of our time. It's really hard to take when you hear it. But she was so dedicated to her students and to creating a place for art within a Ugandan post-colonial situation. I think that's accurate. She left in the 50s before Uganda was actually independent. And Intero's significance is something you go on for a long time as well. I was just rereading this morning his paper in 1963, East African Art.
Yes.
He gave, which I think we probably all have read. But it's a very generous and inclusive definition of East African art, which informs everything I do to this day.
Yeah.
Starting out with the rock art, doesn't actually start with stone tools. I would start with that. But he spends quite a bit of time on rock painting, which I think Trowell didn't know about. And then goes on to talk generously about Injao and Maloba, who were his, he must have been about this, just a little bit later than Maloba. He's always generous with Maloba. I never met him. I did meet his wife, Sarah, in 2002, who literally waxed lyrical about the achievements of Sam in terms of the imagery which he was providing, and particularly the Christian imagery. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I saw a lot here in London, because I used to go to a Lutheran Swahili service, and they had his religious paintings that he made whilst he was here in London, and he gave to the Lutheran church, and then they put them up in the church. So it was really quite wonderful to have these images that were very definitely of the kind of Lutheran churches that I would have known on Kilimanjaro, but here in central London. So he had a way of crossing all of these boundaries. But he was High Commissioner, then he went back to be the Commissioner of Culture. Sam Intero was not a privileged person. He comes from a more humble background than Elimo. I mean, Sam made himself. He was Elimo makes himself too, but in a different sort of way. I have a sense that Sam was more in touch with the environment around him, perhaps, than Elimo was, but that's a different conversation.
Yeah, so Samuel Intero, of course, you know, born in a rural part of Tanzania, but through his kind of academic promise, is given the opportunity to study at Makerere, really is the start of his journey to being not just an artist, but an ambassador and an important participant in Julius Nyerere's government in his role as cultural commissioner. And in fact, the year he sells the painting Chopping Wood that Mitchison buys for Scotland is the year that he becomes the commissioner. And Mitchison is very aware that he is taking on this role because she writes in one of her letters that she's relieved to be able to buy it because once he takes on the role of cultural commissioner, he'll no longer be able to sell his art. Angelo, perhaps you might comment a little bit on Samuel Lintero's significance. I know you have also written about his some of the political overtones of his work that are maybe not always so explicitly discussed, but that there is a kind of perhaps a socialist reading of some of the works that he makes.
Yes, I did write about Sam Tiro and his work. Probably I got myself in trouble. Two doctorates have been written and all of them have these interesting ideas. One is from South Africa, another is from Tanzania. So in other words, I think the story of Tiro is probably still being constructed. And it's interesting how scholars are picking more and more interest. But let me add to what Elsabina said, to say that in my view, Ntiro was not just Trowell's student, but was probably his most trusted lieutenant. I say this because when she left in 1958, she actually left Ntiro in charge of the school. Mm. And that's because she thought that Ntiro would be able to guarantee continuity of some of the ideas that Trowell stood for. And one key idea was this idea that African art, if it were African modern art or whatever, we can even call it African modernism, should not be a copycat of things Western. Of course, Gregory Maroba did not think that Trowell had made a great choice. Maroba didn't doubt that Ntiro was a great artist. However, he didn't think that Ntiro would run a post-Trowellian art school. Maroba did think that the best person for the job should have been a European instructor or someone who at least is of that kind of extraction. His prayers were answered when Cecil Todd was recruited in around mid-1959. Let me also add that I'm not at all suggesting that Trowell's use of the word children was not problematic. However, I think just like Elsabina said, Trowell was speaking and was fluent in Luganda, and she was totally immersed into the cultural traditional tapestry in which she was working. Now, the word children, in reference to school going, let me say people, is not unique to Trowell. Even today, you hear when students have rioted here, the same students aged 20 and above, the local language is not to say that the men and the women of Makerere University have rioted. In fact, they say the children of Makerere University have rioted. Translated from Luganda, Abana be Makerere, the children of the university. So I think I've read, and I think Dr. Sunanda Sanyal led this debate on how Trowell was probably patronizing and maybe racist in some ways. I'm not prepared to take the debate in that direction because I think the word is still being used today, and it is used by people who are Africans, Baganda, and they're using it without any problem whatsoever. The other thing I want to add to Anna is that there was a benefit, I think, to Njau God from his connection with the literature department, maybe through Rebecca Njau. I say this because I kind of contrast the understanding of independence that Njau had with the understanding of independence that Maroba had. If you look at the independence monument, the statue Maroba built to celebrate Uganda's independence, it had this mother and child symbol, fine, that was not unique to him. But his celebratory, ecstatic boy child being hoisted was very, very much probably Maroba believed so much he thought that independence was in fact independence. Njau, on the other hand, was not that hopeful. And that kind of skepticism is what you find in James Ingwenge's The Play of the Black Hermit, which again was in November 1962. And in that play, which was published later, I think in a book in around 1967, you see James Ingwenge or Ngugi wa Thiong'o now questioning whether indeed these boys or elite boys, and you see this on the cover of the play of the Black Hermit, you have this man with a black suit and a white shirt. Ngugi didn't believe that those people, those men, those elite men, were indeed going to deliver their African folks who had trusted them and who were believing that independence was going to change their lives. Now that, I think, connects James Ingwenge, the debate in the literature department, which was raising these questions, with Njau, separating him from the kind of debate you see at the art school. When Cecil Todd had an opportunity to image what he thought was independence, he wasn't different from Njau. He created the coat of arms. He's placing their traditional objects, thinking that they were just pure form. But in fact, there were incredible tensions between the traditions in Buganda, for example, and the new leadership, which he was imagining that Uganda was going to be a republic. So when you pick these traditional objects, which, for example, the Baganda were holding dear and were using to define themselves as traditional, and you'd use them to define the new national state, which the new leadership was imagining was a republic and probably had nothing to do with tradition, then you should be cautious. But Cecil Todd was not. In fact, he created these banners with shields and drums and spears. There was no problem at all. So point I'm making is that Njau and his connection with these views, and he began to raise questions about Uganda's independence and Africa's independence, questions which the other artists who were leading the art school never raised.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Angelo. I want at this point for us to turn to transition, because I think that is a place where artists and writers are, you know, appearing on the pages together. It's also a place where Mitchison published a couple of things, one rather interesting critique of Frantz Fanon in a very sort of confident Mitchisonian sort of way. Transition is this very important journal. I know, Anna, it's one that you have spent a little time working on, obviously in relation to your PhD. So I wonder if you might perhaps pick up a little on some of the things that Angelo is talking about here in terms of debates and discussions at this moment in time, and where transition as this very important journal fits.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. So to give a bit of background to transition, it was a magazine, a literary and political journal established by Rajat Niyogi, who was a Ugandan Asian journalist, writer, / intellectual. And it was established in 1962, and it was, I'd like to say, it was a magazine decades ahead of its time. And Rajat Niyogi, he didn't just publish, you know, East African writers and intellectuals, but he also, you know, looked to the US and published African-American writers and wrote on the civil rights movement and also in apartheid South Africa. So there's very much that sense of Black solidarity. And he didn't shy away from commissioning writers to write critiques of various African leaders, to the point that in 1968, Niyogi was actually arrested by Milton Obote because he published, a writer who wrote something very critical of Obote's authoritarian regime in Uganda. So yeah, it was a very radical magazine. If you browse through its pages, the sense of possibility, the sense of hope, it's almost tangible. And in 1964, Ezekiel Mpalele, or Eski Mpalele as he was later known as, he offered, because Transition had problems with funding, and Rajat Niyogi often had to fund some of the publications himself, he offered him a link to the Congress of Cultural Freedom, which is basically, I know we kind of touched on it earlier, but it was a European-American institution that funded writers, artists, magazines across Europe, Asia, and Africa, and to counter, cultural influence from the USSR. And so the CCF, they funded Transition for a few years, until I believe in 1967 or 1968, the front, there was a big scandal because it was basically funded by the CIA. And Yogi had to, you know, make a statement and say, you know, we didn't know this and the CIA didn't influence our publishing what we were writing at all. But before that, through the CCF, Yogi had access to its network and he developed connections with West African writers and Christopher Okigbo, who was, you know, a well-known Nigerian poet. He was the West Africa correspondent for Transition for a while. And also, yeah, from the 1970s onwards, after Yogi was arrested and couldn't really work and live in Kampala anymore, it was published in Accra in Ghana for a while. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was kind of a brief background to Transition.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's great. And also bringing in this clear sense too, that this is not just the era of independence, but it is also the era of the Cold War. And the Cold War is present in these places through the kind of proxy bodies such as the CCF, funding from things like the CIA. I did just want to quickly return to something. Angela obviously has brought up Gregory Maloba, the sculptor who was Ntiro's contemporary, but also who clashed with Ntiro about certain visions. Maloba's sculpture, the independence sculpture, is that you can actually see it on display in our exhibition because there is a leaflet that I found from the 60s that is advertising Nomo Gallery, amongst other places, the sort of leaflet one might have found in hotel rooms in Kampala in the 60s. And it has Maloba's sculpture on the front of this kind of leaflet. So if anybody is going to the exhibition, they can see Gregory Maloba's rather celebratory sculpture, as Angelo mentioned there. But Elspeth, I wonder if you might, at this point, speak a little about Jack Kadarakawe, who's not somebody we've mentioned so far, and is not, you know, he's not one of the students at Makerere, but he is, you know, Jack is in this world in Kampala and then later, of course, in Nairobi. And he is somebody who is a really significant person in the Argyle collection and somebody whose name was not attached to his work until relatively recently. It would be great if you might share a little bit about where Jack fits.
He's a good person for talking about the dynamism because you can't locate him that easily. But anyhow, locating him. Jack grew up as a herdsboy, as everyone I think knows, in southern Uganda, in Kigezi. He was definitely an outsider in Kampala. You probably also know he spoke Swahili very well. He didn't speak English very well. He didn't go to school. He had a really miserable childhood because his father was poisoned and his mother was not treated well. So he knew how hard life could be. His first experience with sort of local creation was his mother's house painting. His first first meeting of Western art was in the church, where there was this painting of Jesus ascending. And he didn't understand how that painting, how it came. I think he thought it was a photograph or something like that. Someone had to tell him who used a brush to make the work. Now, how he fits into Kampala is that he went to Kampala from Kigezi to look for work. He tried various jobs and he settled as a taxi driver and then became the chauffeur for David Cook. And that's where his life really changes, because Cook, first of all, he went to all of these places as Cook's driver, you know, the nightclubs, the theater, you know, Cook's life became his life. Cook was a bit of a bon vivant. He enjoyed the nightlife, from what I understand. Jack certainly enjoyed the nightlife. So Cook recognized his talent. And one of the things Jack was doing was drawing. Jack did teach, I mean, did start drawing. I think it is partially, even early on, it was a way of knowing himself. The big moment was when David Cook gave him some crayons. David Cook also let Jack live in his house. David Cook lived at, is it Mary Stuart Hall? He had a flat there on the Kampala and the Makerere campus. And Jack had a studio in David Cook's house, or his flat, not his house. And what Cook was able to do also was to introduce Jack to people like Sam. And Sam was Jack's informal teacher from 1965. I have a letter dated 1969 that says he was in touch with Jack all that time. Can I talk about Jack's drawing in your collection?
Yeah, please do talk about Jack's drawing.
Wonderful. I mean, it's the most wonderful drawing for me. As you know, I've exuberated a lot about it because the drawing itself is so well composed, mm-hmm. and is using a motif which we find repeatedly in Jack's work. And I'll just show you this, right? This is a print which he made, I think, in Camp Hall. It would have been with Cook, although he also mentioned, not Cook, Adams, but he also, can you see it? It shows a couple.
Yeah, there's a print of sort of two faces very closely entwined, very much like the drawing that's in the exhibition.
That's exactly. This was his calling card when he was in Nairobi. I think I have that. This is the calling card.
Okay. So this kind of motif of faces, yes.
Jack's motif. And what I like, what I find with this drawing, the drawing which you have in the collection, which you've called Lovers, is that it shows what he was learning. Because if you look at the earlier works in the crayon, it's not so well composed. The drawing itself is rougher. But this one is beginning to see him have the effects, really, of the kind of education he was getting with Sam and Michael Adams, and also Cook. Now, Cook, of course, is a great believer in stories, and this fits in with the visualization aspect of art learning. Jack is having his dreams in his head, which he always talks about. My artwork comes from my dreams. So he's visualizing it in his head and then working it out on paper. Mm-hmm. So it's a key, for me, it's a key moment in his career because I can see the actual his formation coming together as an artist in this work. I was delighted that the Art Mag used it as its cover, but I will also say it's not just the Art Mag. I mean, the Sanaa exhibition in 1984 used a Jack work on its cover. When Polly Savage published her book, Making Art in Africa, The Economist published a work, The Economist magazine published a work of Jack's. Mm-hmm. So people are drawn to his imagery. I think this is very accurate. To me, this is this work is more about a couple getting on with each other. I mean, it's not a man looking down at a woman. It's a man looking for companionship with a woman. And the song, which was so meaningful to us in the 1960s, was Malaika, which is on your playlist. To listen to this particular Malaika, which is a duet between Harry Belafonte and Marion Maceba. Now, Maceba made the song famous. The song itself actually was first sung in Nairobi in the 1940s, 1945, by some Zanzibari musicians who happened to be in Nairobi. So we now know that Nairobi had a nightlife with Malaika then, but it was Maceba who made it famous. And ironically, she learned the song in San Francisco or in LA from a Kenyan in the 1960s. And then she encouraged Belafonte to sing it with her. And then we have this beautiful duet. And it's the word mwanzio, which I like so much in that song, because it, in Swahili, it's companion. Mm-hmm. They're talking to each other as equals. And it's a kind of equity in relationships with men and women that I think the drawing captures, which I think was very much part of our sort of world which we lived in the 1960s, all these volunteer teachers and, you know, the new African elite and all that. It was a kind of really happy time in terms of personal relationships of, for me, that this drawing captures the spirit of that times. And then, of course, now it's got a whole new life with the Michael Armitage exhibition in London. Yes.
This is a wonderful coincidence that Armitage's exhibition opened at the Royal Academy just the day after our little show in Scotland did. But it's wonderful to think that Jack's work is on display in London and in Dunoon.
But I truly couldn't believe it, because we haven't had African work in the London Royal Academy since 1995. And then to walk into this room where he's paying a tribute to the East African artists who have influenced him, but particularly Jack. He has one whole painting called Antigone, which is dedicated to Jack. And it's Jack's drawing with a woman who has her legs open. And the boyfriend is over here, the boyfriend that she wants, or the marriage that she wants. But she's sitting upright and she's very proud. But that's an extremely interesting painting in its own right, which we don't need to discuss here, but you can find online called Antigone, which is related to Jack's work and is written up as a homage to Jack.
Angelo, would you like to come in and tell us a little more about transition, because I see that you may perhaps want to pick up on Anna's comments about the importance of transition, perhaps in the role that artists played with regard to that magazine.
I think I like whatever copies are available, because it do give you a hint about that alternative voice, the alternative voice which was challenging this kind of political negotiation, which was turning into a one-person agenda. And I also like Transition because it did regularly publish matters concerning the visual arts. So some of these artworks are probably lost in the sense that we can't trace their archive. They could be somewhere in the West or in somebody's house or backyard, but we can't easily access them. But reading about them in Transition does give an idea about what kind of art was being produced as Uganda was on a descent from a hopeful nation to a very brutal political space.
We have in the exhibition, we've got two covers of Transition that were designed by Michael Adams, who taught four of the artists who were in the exhibition that were printmaking students. So one of them is the Kwame Nkrumah Lenin that looks like a sort of playing card, I guess. And that was, when that was designed, I think between it being the design being finished and the magazine coming out, Nkrumah was actually overthrown in Ghana. So in many ways, there was this kind of amazing sense that Transition had its finger so tightly on the pulse that politics literally shifted between the cover being designed and the magazine coming out. But yeah, Transition obviously is, you know, remains this incredibly important archive, repository of thinking, writing, visual arts at this moment in time. Now, we're definitely running up on time, so I really should wrap everything up. I just wondered if any of you might like to just say a few words on what do you think the significance of the works that we've got on display are, could be in Scotland today?
Okay, let me say that the beauty then of having this work in the Agaire collection, and the fact that it is open for a bigger and probably expanding audience, not just in Scotland but beyond, because it's accessible electronically, is that then it's going to allow more people to have access to it and be able to see who Jack was, and also to get an idea of what kind of artists were produced by the art school, although not necessarily by the art school in Makerere University, because most times when you speak about contemporary or modern art in Uganda, you begin to get the art school, so-and-so taught so-and-so, and so-and-so was a student of so-and-so. But I think these are the people who probably had contact with the art school, probably learned one or two things from it, but went on to develop a creative practice, which is in parallel, but not exactly under the control of the art school. I'm happy that it is being availed and it's being open to us. So I've already alerted my students to it, and some have already accessed the collection. So you can see it's not just of benefit to Scotland, it's not just of benefit to St. Andrews, it is also benefiting Makerere University students. So I thank you.
That's wonderful to hear, Angela. From my own perspective, I feel this collection is a historic time capsule in many ways. Both, I think, Anna and Angelo have alluded, obviously, to the fact that Uganda in particular enters very difficult straits in the later 60s with the rise of Idi Amin, obviously. And you see, and Elspeth also, in terms of talking about some of the changes that happen in Nairobi, where a lot of Ugandans end up moving to in the 70s. But this collection, you know, bought in the mid 60s through to the kind of late 60s and early 70s, is this kind of little time capsule of this complex, immensely energized moment in history. Anna or Elspeth, I wondered if either of you wanted to come in with any final comments before we wrap up.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in here. Thank you, Kate. I mean, I think there's several reasons why it's important to, you know, people in Scotland and school students. I mean, firstly, I think it's important to diversify the curriculum and to have students look at, you know, non-African and other non-Western pieces of art, in, especially, you know, in line with the decolonizing the curriculum movement that has become big in the UK the past 5 to 6 years. And secondly, I mean, it's not just, you know, we can't just have diversification for diversification's sake. It's also, I mean, the beauty of art, especially, you know, in a time today where various governments around the world are cutting funding towards art and the humanities, it's more important now than ever that art teaches not just visual art, but also literature, teaches people empathy, teaches people the universality of human experience and emotions, and, you know, can help break down perceived walls between groups, communities, cultures, nations. And I think for that reason at all, you know, why not have, you know, an exhibition on African art in Scotland? Because perhaps, you know, that if, you know, young people go and look at it, we'll see that there are perhaps more commonalities and differences between different people. And I think, yeah, and I think it's just very important that this continues to be promoted, especially in this day and age.
That's great, Anna. Yeah, I mean, that certainly is the hope that we can, and we'll be talking about this a little more in our third conversation, but about the kind of potential for this as an educational resource. But exactly this foundational motivation of the Argyle collection was not only to kind of open the minds of young people in this rural part of Scotland, but to use art and culture exactly to do this, to build bridges, to form connections, to allow
understanding. Yes, I was just, well, affirming what Anna was saying. I think very much it's about the human qualities of the artwork and sharing with students of different ages. But I think what Angelo was also suggesting, that the connections be made with tertiary students as well as with younger students. Mm-hmm. On Kilimanjaro, at this point, the history is not being taught in the primary schools, for instance. Mm-hmm. And my collaborator there said that, you know, young people simply don't know who Samantiro is at all. This is generally what we find, so that there's this opportunity for sharing, which is helping to restore some of the history for our friends and colleagues in East Africa as well as here. But the humanness of these works, I think, is what's quite outstanding, which also speaks to that time.
That's wonderful. I think that's a great point to end on, and I hope that we can all agree perhaps that Argyle and Bute are very lucky to have this kind of small but significant collection, and that it can be used hopefully for many years to come to explore all of these kind of complexities of the worlds from which these works came. I want to thank Anna, Angelo and Elspeth for joining me this week and sharing such rich insights into the world of East Africa in the 1960s. Now, these points that were raised at the end of this conversation about the potential of this collection and its public significance are going to be revisited next week in our third and final episode. For this, I'll be getting the original Data Dunoon band back together. I'll have my two wonderful former research assistants, Meredith and Ellie Kem, my colleague Madeline Conn from Argyle and Bute Council, and the wonderful artist Tawona Sithole, who has been responsible for running the first school workshops using the works in this collection. So join us next week for the final episode.